Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Megan Kamrick. Thanks for tuning in. We had some cautious good news from state officials this week that social distancing is helping to flatten the curve on COVID-19 cases. However, the number of However, New Mexico still has more than 2,200 cases of COVID-19 with 71 deaths and 33 people on ventilators. More healthcare workers are becoming ill themselves, and there's an ongoing scramble to ensure enough personal protective equipment, or PPE, is available. At the same time, health orders ban elective surgeries and other procedures. That's hurting many hospitals' bottom lines, and many are laying off workers or instituting furloughs. This morning, we ask, how prepared are hospitals to handle a surge in patients? How will we handle a potential shortage of intensive care beds and ventilators? And our frontline workers getting the support and protection they need? We want to hear from you. If you're on Twitter, get us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Or as always, call in live at 505-277-5866. We'll start with Human Services Secretary Dr. David Scrace. He couldn't be here with us live, but we did do this short pre-recorded interview yesterday. What are the latest projections in terms of when we'll see a peak in cases and a surge in cases?
A surge, as we define it, is when hospitals are seeing enough cases that it's increasing fast enough that they're now above their capacity to serve those people. And so we started by looking at that across the whole state. We counted up all the hospital beds, we counted up all the ICU beds, we counted up all the ventilators, and we realized we needed to substantially increase ICU beds, and hospitals have been very busy and very cooperative with that, had to acquire more ventilators. So that surge is when any hospital, not just all hospitals, are above capacity. Now, that's already happening. It's already happening in Gallup and San Juan, and it's not happening in other places. On the peak is when New Mexico as a whole, or it could be a peak for each county, and we're now modeling by each county. It could be when that number of cases gets the highest. And so that very top of the curve. Now, one thing that's tricky that we're figuring out this week is when you flatten the curve, the peak is more of a longer period of time. It's not just a point. And so as long as that peak, and we think it is below our capacity to serve people, we're good. And we think we're right about there. We need to come up with a few more ICU beds. But apart from that, the combination of our delivery systems really digging deep and creating new ICU capacity, repurposing employees who aren't working on elective surgeries to be trained to work in the hospital. A lot of great things are going on out there. We found ways to retrofit other kinds of breathing machines to turn them into ventilators. And so our capacity to care is going up and the number of cases is coming down and we're finding that they're now meeting. The capacity to serve more people comes from the just heroic efforts of our delivery system leaders. But the lower number of cases, I think, comes from the heroic efforts of every single New Mexican who's gone out of their way to keep social distancing, stay at home, avoid crowds, and all the other public health orders that have come out. I don't want to say that this is over, and I'll say something about Northwest New Mexico in a second, because we only have 1 week of new data, but it makes sense that we believe we have actually flattened this curve out fairly well. All that being said, I mentioned that they're overwhelmed in Gallup and Farmington. We've put a 50-bed Army facility up within the hospital in Farmington to support them there. We have a 50-bed hospital-like facility in a high school gym in Gallup that goes open on Friday. We have sent some ventilators, and the federal government has sent ventilators out there. I know the National Guard is working in Shiprock and Crown Point to provide additional support there up in the Navajo Nation. And so that is a very, very hot spot.
So you're saying that we've flattened the curve significantly. Most of your presentations I've watched, we've usually had this gap in terms of the ICU beds we need, the ventilators we need. Yeah, where does that gap stand now in terms of what we need, what we have on hand?
If the data holds up next week, I think it's looking like there will not be a gap in ventilators or beds and just a little bit, maybe gap of ICU. But we need another week. You can't, because these curves go up steeply and come down steeply, I don't want to provide overconfidence. And even if we're doing great in Santa Fe County, we've got a serious, serious problem in Northwest New Mexico that we can't take our eyes off of.
There are reports that some healthcare workers in various places are now having to do things like make their N95 masks last for a few days. Hospitals are getting into the habit of negotiating for international shipments of personal protective equipment. How is the state helping ensure that there's enough supplies, especially for PPE?
Well, the governor's staff themselves are up late at night every night talking to people overseas, negotiating as well. We've brought in 500,000 or more masks. I don't have all the numbers today. Gowns, gloves, things like that to provide extra supply, because at some point we're going to need PPE for more citizens as well. So the most dramatic thing we can do to conserve PPE is stay home. The more people that stay home, the less cases of COVID, the less PPE that healthcare workers need because they're not overwhelmed with patients. So I think what we're going to need is more than a big giant surge of PPE. We're going to need a steady supply of PPE over a longer time. Remember, when you flatten that curve, it gets lower, but it gets wider as well. It may be almost the same amount of PPE, but we'll have a month or two or three or more to bring it in and supply it. And we've got some very industrious producers in New Mexico who are trying to manufacture this equipment themselves. And by then it'll be tested by the FDA and we're going to be in a better place.
Does this mean we don't need this Army hospital in Albuquerque? Is that still coming?
No, I think, well, I don't know. It's hard to say. ICU beds are still a peak. I think there are multiple good uses to this facility that we've fitted both now for the epidemic and in the future. And particularly over a longer period of time, it may come in very handy for step-down patients, just like the COVID nursing home will. The one on Gibson, the facility is complete. The Army equipment for it is here. It's being unloaded, I'm told, yesterday at Kirtland Air Force Base. It goes into the facility in the next couple of days.
We've seen that prisons and detention facilities can very rapidly become hot spots. If we did have a big outbreak, how would we deal with that?
I think if you have had a big outbreak in the prison, it would begin by mass testing, trying to isolate people the best you could who were negative from the people who are positive. Anyone who is symptomatic would be retested immediately and moved to a third place, or if you have the test results right then, move to the appropriate group. And that's kind of one of the criteria we will want to have in place before things open up, is we have that ability, almost an epidemiological SWAT team ability to descend on a place where it's a high-risk congregate living setting and do the epidemiologic work to isolate cases and everything we're doing for the whole state of New Mexico, but just in a smaller setup. And DOH has the ability to do that and is starting to do that now.
That was Human Services Secretary Dr. David Scrace. I'm joined live now by Jeff Bourgeois. He's the CEO of the San Juan Regional Medical Center in Farmington. Thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Good morning.
It sounds like we're on a good track to lessen the impact on our health systems. But as we heard, you're in northwest New Mexico. It's seeing a huge surge in cases because of clusters in the Navajo Nation. How is your hospital handling this right now?
Well, actually, we're handling it very well. We are not overwhelmed. We have capacity, both in our ICU and in the inpatient floor we've dedicated for COVID patients or potential COVID patients for which we're awaiting test results for. So we've maintained our capacity or our ability to serve the patient loads we've seen. And there's been great collaboration across the state. In anticipation of what might be ahead of us or just around the corner, we have been able to move just a very few patients, probably half a dozen or so, out of our facility to facilities in the Albuquerque area to help us create some additional capacity here should we need it.
How many cases do you have right now in the San Juan Regional Medical Center?
Well, our total inpatient census as of this morning is 114. That's about 30% off of our, you know, average daily census in a non-COVID world, if you will.
Are those COVID and non-COVID cases?
Correct. So okay. We have 21 positive COVID patients, and we have another 18 for which we are awaiting test results. So a total of 39 COVID positive or COVID potential patients out of that 114.
How many are on ventilators?
We have four COVID positive patients on ventilator today and two additional patients that are in that patient under investigation category, as we call it, where we're pending a test result.
Earlier this month, the San Juan Regional Medical Center sent out requests for donations for surgical caps and masks. Do your workers have the personal protective equipment they need?
We certainly do. I've really got to give a lot of credit to our emergency preparedness team. We have a wonderful inventory of PPE. A lot of folks like me that don't work in the clinical areas are wearing homemade masks, and the surgical caps are an area we seek those donations in advance of running short, if that makes sense. So we don't run short. So we maintain an adequate inventory on hand.
And have any of your workers contracted COVID-19?
We have had some healthcare workers in this community test positive. To date, to my knowledge, none of the contact tracing suggests that those individuals were exposed on the job. They were more community-based exposures.
This is the KUNM call-in show. I'm Megan Kamrick. I'm talking with Jeff Bourgeois from the San Juan Regional Medical Center in Farmington. Have you had to go to the hospital during this time? What did you notice about the staff and facilities? Did you feel safe? Tell us about it. You can call 277-5866. What protocols do you have in place, Jeff, for if someone is suspected to have COVID symptoms?
Well, we have a couple of different ways we are addressing that. First, on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday of every week from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., we are holding a external assessment area where patients who we've screened via a telephone screening process for symptoms or risk factors to suggest they might have been exposed or might be symptomatic with COVID-like symptoms, we invite them to come through this line for and stay in their car. And we'll do the nasal swab there and send it off for resulting. And then for patients presenting to the emergency department, we actually have separated our emergency department into what we call a respiratory and non-respiratory side. And the purpose of that is to keep all patients with what are known as influenza-like illnesses or symptoms on the respiratory illness side. And, of course, they are immediately masked as the patients themselves. The staff have all the appropriate PPE in place as they begin their clinical assessment and diagnosis of the patient.
We have seen other parts of the country where outbreaks in jails and prisons can spread very rapidly. How are you preparing for that possibility if there was an outbreak in detention facilities in your region?
Well, and it's not just detention facilities. It's facilities with congregate living.
So nursing homes and...
Yes, exactly. So we are staying in contact with the leaders of those organizations to understand how many positive patients they may have in their facilities. Of course, you know, we know that 80% of the people that test positive are truly asymptomatic or have a mild course of illness that don't need hospitalization. So we're keeping our lines of communication open with those facilities so we can understand what potential patient care volume we might see from them actually coming to the hospital. And then we also are keeping in contact through our chief medical officer with colleagues in Shiprock and Gallup to determine what their patient care volumes are. And then we have a great line of communication into a central hub, if you will, in Albuquerque. That is, the hospitals down there have been wonderful to offer support be willing to take patients from our facility should we need to do that.
Farmington is a hub not only for Northwest New Mexico, but also Southwest Colorado. And the governor in Colorado is discussing reopening the economy. How might this impact your hospital?
Well, I was listening to him on the way in to work this morning, Megan. That's a great question that I do not have an answer to. I think it's all a function of how well individuals everywhere maintain appropriate social distancing, even if they are outside of their home and take infection prevention measures seriously, such as hand washing, et cetera. Early on, we saw a lot of patients coming to us from northeastern Arizona, we appreciate the work the leaders of the Navajo Nation have done to really put in place strict social distancing rules across the Navajo Nation, and I think that's beginning to show some benefit as they are attempting to flatten their curve on the Navajo Nation.
This morning, we're talking about how hospitals are preparing for a possible surge of patients from the coronavirus pandemic. While we go to a quick break, remember, our phone lines are open. Call 277-5866 to join in. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. We'll be back in a minute.
Support provided by Weekly Alibi, covering news, arts, and entertainment for Albuquerque since 1992. The friends at Weekly Alibi invite the community to help support local independent journalism when it's needed the most. Info at alibi.com/friends.
The Rothstein Donatelli Law Firm is committed to supporting KUNM, where the law firm's criminal practice can help clients petition state courts to permanently remove public records related to criminal charges and certain convictions. Rothsteinlaw.com.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, next time on Latino USA. Advice for life in self-quarantine. Advice columnist John Paul Bremer imparts his wisdom for these strange new times.
It's sort of like the whole world is a little bit sick right now, and you don't run marathons when you're sick. You go take a rest.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 FM KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about hospital readiness and COVID-19. What questions do you have about a patient surge and how it will be handled at hospitals around the state? Are you a healthcare worker in a hospital? What are you concerned about right now? Give us a call this hour, 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866. We're also on Twitter. Use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. And I'm here with Jeff Bourgeois. He's CEO of the San Juan Regional Medical Center in Farmington. Jeff, you also began temporary furloughs last week for some employees and some staff salary reductions. Why did you need to do that?
Well, the public health order issued by the state, which is the appropriate thing to do, has a very negative impact on healthcare providers and their ability to do and perform non-essential services as defined by the healthcare order. And that has an immediate negative impact on the volume of patient care services that we are allowed to deliver. We have seen our emergency department volumes almost cut in half for most of the days since the order was delivered. And then our elective surgical and procedural schedule, such as screening colonoscopies, elective surgeries, et cetera, have really been throttled back. And, you know, we anticipate about a $10 million cash collection decline on a month-to-month basis from where we were in the pre-COVID world. So that requires any business to make adjustments as needed. So we began at the top. I took a 25% pay cut. The rest of the executive team took a 20% pay cut. We have a number of employed physicians and advanced practice providers, and working with the physician leaders there, developed a plan where most of those providers who are not in the direct clinical care responding to this COVID response also volunteered for a 20% pay cut, and we took measures to make sure that our ER physicians and hospitalists and primary care, urgent care, those clinicians that are on the front line, that we took measures to keep them whole, even though, as unintuitive as it seems, the volume of patient care they're treating is actually declined, and often, you know, they're on a productivity-based type of compensation. So we took measures to make sure to keep them whole in the face of dealing with the uncertainty of dealing with COVID cases. And then we began to look at our non-staffing related expenses and made a number of expense reductions and working with vendors to defer payments, change annual payments to monthly payments, everything we could to slow the rate at which cash was leaving the hospital. And then we finally looked at the balance of the workforce and made furloughs where there was just not work to be done anymore. We had adequate staff to respond to our COVID clinical care needs, and in a lot of our elective procedures and clinic facilities. And we tried to do that in a way where we could offer a rotating furlough, a week on, a week off, so we could keep people connected to the facility. We're maintaining their health and dental and vision insurance benefits through the furlough, and plan on calling them back at such time as our volumes return.
Oh, that's good to know. Well, Jeff Bourgeois with the San Juan Regional Medical Center, thank you so much for joining us this morning here on KUNM.
Hey, my pleasure, Megan. Thank you, and appreciate the work you all are doing.
Thank you so much. I'm joined now by Hunter Marshall. He's a nurse in the COVID unit at the University of New Mexico Hospital. Hunter, what are you seeing right now at UNMH in terms of COVID patients and bed capacity?
Before I answer any questions, I will just say really quick as a caveat that I am an employee at the University of New Mexico Hospital, however, not a representative. I'm just speaking as an employee.
Understood.
For the organization at large.
Got it.
In the COVID ICU right now, we are a 24-bed unit. That's typically the medical ICU. And slowly over the past couple weeks, we have seen ourselves fill up from being partly rule-out patients to now our unit is completely full with COVID-positive patients. And another ICU, a second ICU, the trauma surgical ICU, has taken over as the rule-out unit where they have quadrants of rule-out patients and now positive patients. So our census of COVID-positive patients has expanded, and as of yesterday, an email sent out said that there was 27 positive inpatients.
And New Mexico In Depth reported on the increasing numbers of healthcare workers in various hospitals who are getting sick with COVID-19. Are you seeing that?
I won't speak to the exact numbers. That would be something that the university hospital would have to respond to. But I have interacted with multiple employees of the hospital who have had COVID and recovered. Yes.
What kind of impact is this having on staffing and on those workers and their families?
I think there's, to answer about staffing first, whether somebody is positive and needs to be out for a two-week quarantine, or whether they just had a workplace exposure, they need to be out for a two-week quarantine. And that has been deleterious to staffing, to say the least. In part, we've had several workers who had workplace exposures due to changes in PPE policy that offered a less protective form of PPE. And those folks are out for 2 weeks. And then the human cost of this, I actually think, is the most important. I work with folks who aren't going home to their families at the end of the day because they had an exposure and don't want to risk spreading it to their children or if they live with their parents. And that's an added, not only stress, but also can be an added financial stress if people are paying for elsewhere to stay as a means of protecting their family.
You have been talking to officials at UNMH and in the media about personal protective equipment and worker safety. What are your primary concerns?
The primary concern is that the level of protection afforded with our current PPE policy is not keeping staff as safe as would be the case if we had an adequate supply of PPE. An example is that prior, like as COVID started, the policy of the hospital was, and this is what the CDC says ideally should be done with these patients, is one mask and gown and all of that for each time you go in a room, and then take that off when you leave the room as to not contaminate elsewhere. Now the policy is that we are to use that one N95 mask for 3 days. While this still is the CDC recommendation, which hospitals will say, it's the CDC's recommendation for crisis strategies to optimize the supply of N95 masks. And the quote from the website, the CDC website, which you can look up, is that these are not commensurate with current U.S. standards of care. So the concern is that hospitals continue to say they are providing adequate safety equipment when the reality for those of us working on the front lines, feels like that is not the case. And then as there are more healthcare workers getting sick, it raises questions as to who is responsible if it is indeed a workplace exposure that leads to illness or hospitalization.
What would you like to see happen to keep people safe?
Right now, I think that the hospital has an amazing team of physicians and other clinicians working to optimize the supply of protective equipment we do have. The fact is that there's not enough, there's insecurity in the supply chain. I think the hospital is doing the best they can to keep people safe. That said, the hospital can provide added financial protections for staff. So right now, if somebody faces an exposure or needs to be out for 2 weeks because they are sick, that comes out of workers' sick time and PTO. And I've had colleagues who've had a couple exposures and see all of their sick paid time off disappear. So having administrative leave rather than depleting our PTO and other times. And then many folks would like to see hazard pay implemented. Folks who are staying away from their families for the purposes of not wanting to risk infecting them, having an alternate place to stay is important, and having a bit of financial assistance to afford that alternate place to stay. And then I think ultimately what clinicians like myself want to see from RTs to our EVS folks, everybody just wants a level of transparency from the hospital. To what degree is the PPE shortage informing changes of PPE policy? And also an acknowledgement that from the hospital that the fact is they cannot give us the same level of protection that they were able to in the absence of a PPE crisis. An acknowledgement that as a healthcare system globally, healthcare workers have been failed and are not being protected at the level that they are accustomed to and should be. That acknowledgement and then expression of gratitude that, despite the personal risk to ourselves, we continue to show up to work and care for these patients.
Well, UNMH declined to make anyone available for our show, but they sent a statement that we have posted at KUNM.org under the show. In summary, UNM Health, they said, has been and continues to be thoughtful about the proper use, decontamination, and reissue of personal protective equipment. And they also have a statement about leave they make available for employees. You can read the full statement at KUNM.org. Right now, though, I want to turn to Eleanor Chavez. She's executive director of the National Union of Hospital and Healthcare Employees, District 1199 in New Mexico. Eleanor, your organization represents workers, I believe, in five hospitals in central and northern New Mexico. Are you seeing issues such as those described by Hunter in parts of the state other than Albuquerque?
Absolutely. The biggest concern, you know, as Hunter stated, is the lack of personal protective equipment. And, you know, when you look at what the hospitals are saying in terms of, you know, how much they have, I think we need to remember that they have, you know, what they call sufficient supplies right now because they're restricting access and are forcing workers to wear their masks for 3 days. You know, some workers don't even have access to the masks. For example, techs in some of the ICUs don't have access where they should to the N95, so that puts them at greater risk. You know, we would like for the hospitals to be a bit more aggressive in obtaining PPE. You know, there's other alternative PPE equipment that we have identified that it's a bit more expensive, it's more durable, it's easily disinfected, and it lasts for years. So going to this sort of, you know, disposable model of PPE, I think is one of the reasons that we're having a hard time, or the hospitals are having a hard time, you know, getting it because there's such a demand in this country.
Are you seeing more layoffs and furloughs as well as hospitals are grappling with this loss in revenue?
We are. What we're seeing is, you know, we've had some furloughs at Christa St. Vincent's in Santa Fe and Alta Vista in Las Vegas. What we're seeing at UNMH, and at the Los Alamos Medical Center is what's called census management. So that doesn't necessarily fall into the category of furlough or layoff. What that means is that the number of hours that workers are able to work is reduced. So, you know, like yesterday, I got a call from one of our members at UNMH letting me know that they're now being furloughed at least a day a week. We've had calls from other members saying that they've been furloughed for up to 2 days a week. In Los Alamos, some of the RNs there, their hours are being reduced by half. So there's sort of now really three categories, you know, furloughs, layoffs, and reduction in hours.
But it's all a drop in income.
Exactly.
Okay. What would you like to see happen to address some of these issues for these healthcare workers?
Well, we would like for the hospitals, all of them, to bargain in good faith with us. We actually, at the beginning of March, sent all of the hospitals where we represent workers a letter asking them to sit down and negotiate with us over the impacts of COVID-19. We knew that it was going to get this bad, and we wanted the hospitals to be able to plan so that we could be able to lessen the impact both economically, but also in terms of their safety. That was the number one issue for us. We wanted all of the workers in those hospitals to be safe, and we made some recommendations, you know, in terms of how they could do that.
Just before I let you go, I have a quick question for Hunter and Eleanor. Michael from Santa Fe called in and brought up an example in Austria. It went from 800 cases a day to 58, in part because of mandatory masks in public. So do you all agree this could help lessen the burden on you as healthcare workers?
I think it could. I think that, I mean, there's sort of some mixed reviews on that, but I think that we need to do everything possible because the reality is the more it's spread and the more people that get sick is going to have a devastating impact, not only in our community, but also on the healthcare workers that we have available. Hunter talked a little bit about, you know, workers who have COVID. We have several workers who are out just because they've been exposed. So that creates, you know, increased pressure on the number of workers available. So whatever the community can do to stop the spread, we would certainly appreciate it.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. This is the KUNM call-in show. We're talking about hospital readiness today. Do you perhaps have an elderly or ill relative that might have to be taken to emergency services? What are your concerns about that? Call 277-5866. Joining us now is Dr. Denise Gonzalez. She's medical director and intensive care unit physician with Presbyterian Healthcare Services. Albuquerque hospitals often get patients from other parts of the state who need acute care. 90% of our intensive care beds are in Albuquerque. Dr. Gonzalez, how many patients do you have right now with COVID-19 at Presbyterian's facilities around the state?
Good morning, and thank you for having me on. I am the one of the three medical directors over our central command center hub, and that includes I would say, an amazing and unprecedented level of collaboration between Loveless, the university, and Presbyterian Healthcare. And in our central hub, where we have the greatest number of beds, as you highlighted, so we currently have 128 ICU patients, and 53 of those 128 are on mechanical ventilation. However, we should be reassured somewhat that we are only at 72% of our usual licensed occupancy for critical care beds in central New Mexico.
Well, that's good to know. And so do you feel your hospitals will be able to keep up if there's a surge in COVID cases?
I think that the state of New Mexico has been incredibly collaborative over the last 5 to 6 weeks. The governor has helped pull us all together with various committees that have been very thoughtful about how we would respond to this pandemic in New Mexico. And so we do have a very good plan in terms of setting up regional hubs throughout the state, and those regional hubs serve their spoke hospitals. They have daily calls to talk about how they're going to load level. And we've set up the Central Command Center as the ultimate relief valve so that if those regional areas become overwhelmed, then patients can be sent into the central hub.
We have to go to a quick break, but this morning we're talking about how hospitals are preparing for a possible surge of patients from COVID-19. Remember, our phone lines are open, 277-5866. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. On KUNM, I'm Megan Kamrick. We'll be back in just a minute.
Support provided by Organic Books, a family-owned and operated independent bookstore in Albuquerque. Although the doors are currently closed, the community can still access books and gift certificates from the comfort of home at organicbooks.net.
Support comes from Positive Energy Solar, a local employee-owned benefits corporation installing solar electric systems in neighborhoods across New Mexico since 1997. Info on solar for homes and businesses at positiveenergysolar.com.
With billions of dollars in aid money available, tribes are grateful for the relief, but some are also frustrated. Some tribes are expressing concerns about how those funds are divided up. On the next Native America Calling, we'll learn more about the $8 billion for tribes in the CARES Act.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about hospital readiness and hospital health during the COVID-19 pandemic. What questions do you have about how prepared our hospitals are to deal with coronavirus? Join the conversation by calling 505-277-5866. Toll-free, the long-distance number is 1-877-899-5866 for those of you on landlines. Or you can email letstalk@kunm.org. I'm here with Dr. Denise Gonzalez. She's medical director and intensive care unit physician with Presbyterian Healthcare Services. Dr. Gonzalez, how is your supply of personal protective equipment? Some of your healthcare workers expressed some concern to New Mexico in depth recently about not having enough to stay safe.
You know, there's been a national plan that has been set up in the past. We've had past issues with some people may recall Ebola, and there were national stockpiles that were set up. What we did discover is that despite this planning, with this pandemic, we exceeded what was in the national stockpile. So we've had to be very ingenious in terms of how we manage our PPE. I think that we've all gone through periods of time where we feel stressed and have the fear that perhaps we don't have sufficient PPE, but I think that we have, over the last 5 to 6 weeks, been able to find the correct supplies, find alternate uses. Lots of organizations in the public and private sector have really stepped up and donated plenty of PPE. In fact, some schools are even 3D printing masks to help protect healthcare workers.
Yes, we have covered some of that on our Your New Mexico Government show. There's a lot of those efforts going on. How are you sourcing more?
We've been able to use our supply chain to be able to acquire more PPE, as well as using systems to recycle or reuse PPE. Although the general usage outside of pandemic is that we take a mask and then discard it immediately after a single use. It's not necessarily required that we do such things. And so through careful use and sterilization processes, we can have pretty significant reuse of masks in particular.
How many of your staff have contracted COVID?
I'm unaware of the rate of infection amongst our staff.
Okay. How are you supporting your employees during this time?
Yeah, so I can tell you what my experience has been practicing clinically. We have been able to set up separate units for COVID-positive patients and a separate unit for those who are either under investigation or COVID-negative. We have delivery systems set up to deliver the appropriate amount and type of PPE to individuals who are working in those COVID positive units. So I think that between those processes and setting up some pretty clear lines of who gets to go where, that has been very helpful. But I think that there's some other important things beyond just the PPE and the physical plant. And that's that we've recognized that this is a very stressful time. So we also provide resources for emotional support to our employees, as well as the ability to change into scrubs when you come in to work and change out of them before you go home. We're going to soon be offering showering facilities so that people can shower off as they leave work. And then hotel resources for those people who truly want to be able to stay away from their family during the time that they're delivering clinical care.
Well, we know that also we have such a large state, and rural hospitals face their own set of challenges. We're joined right now by Kay Green. She is CEO of Roosevelt General Hospital in Portales. Thank you for joining us this morning, Kay.
My pleasure, Megan. Thank you.
You have a small hospital. It's about 20 beds. Have you had many cases of COVID-19?
No, we haven't. So we do have a 24-bed hospital, and we have a 4-bed ICU. But I guess what I wanted to share is up until yesterday, we had only had one positive case of COVID-19 within our county in Roosevelt. Yesterday, that number increased to 4. Mm. But that doesn't really change a lot of how we take care of people, because everyone who comes into our hospital with any kind of a respiratory illness or any flu-like symptoms, we have to make an assumption that they very well could have COVID-19. So even though no one in our hospital has tested positive yet, with the exception of the one outpatient that we got the result on yesterday, we have had, on average, about 4 patients every week in our hospital that we suspected had COVID-19. So we had to put them in isolation in negative pressure rooms. No one has required to be on a ventilator yet in our hospital. We're very grateful for that. But it's not until we get the test result back, which can be anywhere from 2 to 5 days later, that we've got a confirmation that they did not have COVID-19. So we're having to take all the same precautions, even though our patients have tested negative to date as inpatients.
Well, I have both Dr. Denise Gonzalez and Kay Green on the line. We have a caller from Los Lunas. Shelley asks, do we know how many people are being turned away because they're not sick enough or can manage better at home? What is your protocol, both of you, for that?
If it's okay, I'll take the lead.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not turning anyone away that requires hospitalization. So if they meet criteria for either inpatient hospitalization or observation, those folks are being admitted just like any other time. Now, we are following CDC guidelines that if someone comes into our clinic setting with flu-like symptoms but does not require hospitalization, we're screening them, we're testing them, and we're giving them guidance to go home and manage their symptoms. But if they're in any kind of an acute distress, we are not turning anyone away, and I want to make that very clear.
And Dr. Gonzalez?
Yeah, I agree with that. That response is spot on and exactly in alignment with what we are doing and what I expect the rest of the state is doing. We are operating business as usual. If you need medical care, we will care for you. We are not rationing care or limiting care. We're just taking extra precautions in terms of the transmission of COVID. But other than that, if you need care in our hospitals or in our clinics, we will deliver that care.
And I have another caller, and apologies, Shelley. I'm getting used to doing this remotely. It's a little different than we used to do here in times of COVID. Kathleen from Albuquerque has a question about volunteer medical corps. Are you there, Kathleen?
Yes.
What was your question?
Well, I wanted to know if the IHS or the tribes have similar programs that physicians can volunteer to assist.
Do either of you know anything about that?
I do not.
Several offers from community physicians to volunteer to assist, and where we're able to redeploy those volunteers, we have. But I'm not familiar with what IHS may be doing.
Okay. And Kate, you had to take some creative steps to find PPE. You had to get into the international importing business?
We did, yes, actually. I think like many other hospitals, our normal supply chain was unable to provide PPE as we started ramping up for this. And we have a New Mexico rural hospital network that we're a member of. And there are about 11 other rural hospitals in our state who are members of, and we pay for this. We created this several years ago. And our executive director actually found an alternate supply chain directly from China for us to be able to get various PPE. And so we availed ourselves to that. We've gotten two shipments now from China that includes KN95 masks, surgical masks, Tyvek suits. So that was really our only option in order to prepare our hospital. I'm glad to say that the prices were higher than we normally paid, but they actually weren't any higher than what other vendors were charging in the United States at that time. But it appears that our normal supply chains now have replenished, and we're now able to get supplies through our historical routes, if you will. But yes, we did have to get very creative in order to prepare our hospital.
I have a quick question from Roger about PPE. Roger, what is your question for us?
Yes, good morning. I wanted to ask for clarification. On the one hand, we have people saying that we have enough PPE, such as face masks. On the other hand, we're using them following CDC guidelines, but nurses don't feel that that's an adequate way to approach this, that they, in regular procedures, they change these masks coming in and out of any room. Can you tell us who's correct here? Either we have enough or we don't to keep our people safe. Can you respond to that, please?
Dr. Gonzalez, perhaps you'd want to respond to that?
Sure. I think that in times of crisis, there's always fear and lack of sufficient communication. So I'll give you my opinion and expressed because of the level of information that I have. I do feel that we are following CDC guidelines and that we do have sufficient PPE and that we are keeping all of our employees safe.
Okay. Eleanor, I know that this is an ongoing issue between the hospitals and nurses, so it sounds like it's going to be a continuing dialogue. Oh, Eleanor, are you still there? We don't have Eleanor. Okay. Well, I do, but we don't have much time left, and I want to make sure we have one more person to bring into this conversation. Jeff Dye is Executive Director of the New Mexico Hospital Association. Jeff, this is presenting a huge challenge financially to hospitals right now. We've heard a little bit of that from Jeff Bourgeois and from Kay. Why is it hurting, especially rural hospitals, even though we all agree the public health orders are a good idea? But what is the dynamic here?
Well, good morning, Megan. And I don't want to repeat some of the things that were said by others, but I think some of the representatives of other hospitals really, we have some of the best and brightest folks working in hospitals trying to manage this situation. But there are some conundrums created, and the public health order around reductions of non-essential services are exactly what's needed in our state right now to reduce the spread of disease and to preserve PPE. So the strategy is right, but like everything related to this pandemic, there are pros and cons and pluses and minuses. And so you already heard some description of the reduction of revenue at the hospitals that are involved in compliance with the public health order. So we've tried to quantify that a little bit, and although the order went into effect only March 24th, hospitals were already adhering to some of the CDC guidelines before that. But you know, for March, we compiled some information and determined the net effect for hospitals is about a $81 million impact just for 1 month.
That's a lot.
So that represents lost revenue as well as COVID-related expenses for standing up various services and reorganizing their operation. So it's a huge impact just for 1 month, and it really just represents a week or so of reduced non-essential services, as are described.
We have an email from a listener, Jason, who says he wants Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham to make an emergency and disaster preparedness a legislative priority. He also agrees with Republican state lawmaker Rebecca Dow, who wants Lujan Grisham to allow hospitals to have more flexibility to provide more services during this time. Thank you for those comments, Jason. Jeff Dye, what state action do you think is most needed to address crises like this now and or moving forward?
Well, it's a national and state challenge, just preparedness in general. We seem to go in cycles. We deal with some of the national issues that we've seen, whether it's hurricanes or fires and bombings and so forth, and we develop preparedness programs around those different issues. This pandemic, I think, is a game changer. It's pervasive. It's not localized. You know, when we have a hurricane in Florida, New Mexicans go help, and vice versa. When there's a forest fire in New Mexico, we have firefighters come from somewhere else. This scenario is so pervasive. It affects all of us. It affects all Americans. It's affecting our whole world at the same time. So it's obviously going to change society in the future, which is for another discussion. But investment in preparedness is going to have to be a new priority and a new way of thinking, for sure.
Kay Green with Roosevelt General Hospital, do you feel that you could offer some of these services you can offer now, such as colonoscopies, other non-emergency services, and do it safely so that your hospital could have some of this revenue?
Yes, I do. And I think it's hospital dependent. In my case, I think we've got a very clear path where we could ensure our surgical or procedural patients are separated from anyone who might have COVID exposure. So we have that ability to cordon off our surgical area. And as I mentioned before, we have sufficient PPE on hand. So I do believe, I don't think we should just completely say, let's open up all non-essential services. But what I would advocate for is each hospital in good faith assess what we believe we can safely do for all of our patients.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time today. A big thank you to all my guests, Jeff Bourgeois, Hunter Marshall, Eleanor Chavez, Jeff Dye, Kay Green, and Dr. Denise Gonzalez. And thanks to everyone who called in and sent questions and comments. I apologize if we didn't get to all of you on air. We do love to hear from you. If you missed part of today's show, you can listen on KUNM.org or subscribe to Let's Talk New Mexico on your podcast app of choice. For the last few weeks, KUNM and our partners New Mexico PBS and the Santa Fe Reporter have been putting out a show called Your New Mexico Government about all aspects of the pandemic. On last night's episode, we heard about the pandemic's impact on people experiencing homelessness and police response. Tonight's episode looks at politics, voting, and the census in the time of COVID. Don't miss it. It's Your New Mexico Government on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and airing weeknights at 7:30 on KUNM. Support for our public health coverage comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and listeners like you. A huge thank you to our inflappable engineer Marino Spencer and Kaveh Movahed on the phones. We're a couple or a few of the people going into the radio station these days. Bryce Dix live tweeted today's show, which was produced by Ty Bannerman. Our executive producer is Interim News Director Hannah Colton. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to Let's Talk New Mexico.